Hey Brock, so this is Christmas, and what have you done?
Done some Christmas shopping, drove around a lot, and
Another year over, and a new one's just begun.
yeah, it's pretty cool. Are you quoting John Lennon?
Nope. And so this is Christmas. We hope you have fun.
Yeah. I hope you have fun too, bud.
I'm quoting John Lennon.
Yeah, I know.
Okay, let's just do the show. What's going on, everybody? My name is Sati Miele.
And I'm Brock Berenson.
And you're listening to So You're an Artist. It's the only podcast where we ask the all too important questions. So You're an Artist.
But what is your real job?
Oh man, dude, Christmas is next week and it's my favorite holiday of the year.
Yeah, you're gonna watch Die Hard like every other basic bitch?
Yes. Yeah, I'm gonna watch. Yeah. Yeah, I'm probably gonna watch Die Hard.
Good. Live your best
You know
life.
what?
Don't let the media skew the way you want to live your life.
The first time I saw that movie was not around Christmas. I was 14 years old, and I very much enjoyed it. My mom thought it was a family-friendly comedy, and she rented it for me. And it instantly became one of my favorites. So, yeah, I'm going to watch Die Hard this Christmas. No, it's not a Christmas movie, but or it's a movie. I don't think.
It's a
I don't know
Christmas
if it's a
movie.
Christmas movie.
The
Is it?
writers confirmed that it's a Christmas movie.
Oh, I did not know that. Okay, well, perfect. Then it's
Yeah.
a Christmas movie, and I will be watching Die Hard. And I hope our listeners will be watching Die Hard or their favorite Christmas movie as well.
Yeah. Fun fact, I actually learned that fun fact that it is a Christmas movie from the Stuff You Should Know podcast. Also,
Are you about to do an unpaid plug for the Stuff You Should Know
no, I'm
podcast?
just saying it's a great podcast and everyone should listen to it. But I also watched Die Hard for the first time in 2018 at or during Christmas time.
And how fucking awesome was it?
It was pretty awesome. It's I've watched it multiple times since then.
What okay, what's like your go-to Christmas movie then?
I don't know if I really have one. I love A Christmas Story. I love Nightmare Before Christmas. But I watch that at least between October and December. At least once.
I grew up with Polar Express, so that one comes around
I
every
did
year.
watch Polar Express a couple of years when I was younger.
I was obsessed with that movie. When I first saw it, I wanted to be like a train engineer, the guy at the front of the
That's
train
totally
operating
fair,
everything.
though. Yeah,
Yeah. Oh, that movie made me, I was like train crazy after seeing that movie. I wanted to have dude, I got so into this stuff. There's a company called Lionel, which makes like little scale model trains, and they had a Polar Express model, and I was like, oh, the thing costs like $400,
Of
so of
course.
course I never fucking got it. But it was like this ultra realistic like electric train set. I wanted it so bad.
That's amazing.
Anyway, we have a fun guest. I had this interview went so well. She was fantastic.
Yeah, honestly.
It flowed really smoothly. So, Brock and I last week sat down with actor and theater director and educator Sabina Zuniga Varela. We sat down with her to once again, like we discussed with Dr. Daphne Sicre, we sat down to discuss Latinx representation in drama, but at the same time, we also discussed her career and her cultural and social upbringing in New Mexico. We talked a lot about there's a lot of talk about New Mexico at the beginning because I used to go during the summers. And Brock, you crushed it with the drawing challenge this time. This one was really cool.
Thank you.
And I'm excited for you guys to see it on our Instagram page. So Sabina shares her story with us and how she actually grew up more as an educator and then transitioned from teaching to acting within the last decade. And her move out to Los Angeles and actually her having almost the opposite of a cultural shock. She felt really at home here because she talks about how she kind of watched this place through, the media in her own home. And then we talk about her also, making some television appearances. Speaking of which, you can catch her in the fourth season of Snowfall, which will be airing on FX, and it's available on Hulu the next day. She also has a guest recurring role on Madam Secretary in season six. Check that out on Netflix. If you want to get to know Sabina better, you can go ahead and check out her website, which is sabinazunigavarela.com. That's spelled SabinaZunigavarela.com. Or check out her Instagram, which is just her first, middle, and last name, like I just spelled all at once. Go ahead and follow her there. We also lastly discussed a project that she's been working on in the last handful of months, which is the Luis Alfaro Greek trilogy, consisting of Oedipus el Rey, Mojada, and Electricidad. And now the readings of these plays are available on YouTube on the Getty Museum YouTube channel, and we will also have a link to the full playlist on our Instagram.
I didn't ask it during the interview, but what are the actual Greek tragedies in? Because I know it's
Oh.
Oedipus Rex, and I don't know the other two.
So the first one is Oedipus Rex or Oedipus the King. The second one, Mojada, is the tragedy of Medea. And the last one, Electricidad, I think that's the tragedy of Electra. Yes, it is the tragedy of Electra. That is the final one. But, yeah, man, I feel like I've run my mouth long enough here.
I
What
think
about you? You
so.
got anything else to add? Yeah.
I don't have anything to add.
All right. Well, then, with that great shame, let's get into the interview. I notice, is it Zuniga or Zuniga? Like, because I noticed the Enya above the N.
Yes. So you know that those of us that have Latino names sometimes have to code switch.
Right.
So for many years, it was Sabina Zuniga Varela. And then when I booked my first television gig, I decided to honor the actual pronunciation of that surname, which is Zuniga
Okay.
Varela. So if you look at most of my all of my television work, it has the tilde and the accent. So it's Zuniga.
Right. Yeah, I noticed that. I've 100%. I've seen like there's everyone's favorite from The Office, Oscar. Everyone calls him Oscar Nunez, the actor's
Yes.
name, but it's
Yeah.
Nunez.
Yes.
So I've seen that code switch a bunch of times, and I'm Argentinian. Well, I'm was born here, but my mom is Argentinian Italian. So I speak the language, and it bothers me sometimes.
I know. It's an interesting, I think there's been many conversations I've had over the past even couple decades of folks that are just like, "Ooh, should I change my name? Should I make it easier and more palatable for the wider general public?" And lately, I've had such a great time reading articles and stories of people that are saying basically, learn our names. And if somebody feels like it's too complicated, take the time to teach them. You know, and let's go ahead and give that homage to our ancestors of this is who we are and where we came from, you know.
Yeah. To be perfectly honest, also phonetically, it's not that hard.
It's really not that
It's
hard.
not difficult.
It's really not that hard. Yeah.
And then the second question, where in New Mexico are you?
So at this point, I'm currently in the village of La Puente, which is in the Chama Valley, northern New Mexico, very rural in Rio Riba County. And I kind of grew up country mouse, city mouse in between Albuquerque and the Tierra Maria area. And
Right.
we're in the tiny little village called La Puente.
Oh, that must be really nice. I used to travel to New Mexico every summer to visit some friends in Santa Fe. We'd go by
Oh, yeah.
train. And while we were up there, we never we went into the city a couple times, but it's like you're 14 years old. There's not that maturity to appreciate the history of, and the especially the indigenous value that the whole place brings, from literally from the architecture to the food to all of the items sold in like the local markets and stuff like that. So I'd like to go back now after, learning a little bit more.
Absolutely. It's one of the most, I feel, sacred and magical places. And I know that, it has a, the land here is very interesting because if it doesn't like you, it'll spit you out. So there's been
Really?
many people that have come through or, oh yeah, I've been there. I didn't really like it. It's like, that's fine. We don't need more people here. But when it embraces you, when you're open to it, it will envelop you and enchant you. It's called the land of enchantment for a reason.
Right.
Yeah, so yes, definitely come back sometime and hit me up because I have lots of connections and suggestions.
Absolutely. I think the furthest, let's see, we visited I believe it was Santa Rosa, the lake, the part
Oh
where
yeah,
they're
the blue
like,
hole. Yeah.
yeah, went swimming in that, and I couldn't do the, like, what is it? They have like a 20-foot jump and then the 8-foot
Yeah.
jump. I don't
Nope. I'm not a fan of that.
yeah, but
Near.
my brother did it. He went up to like the highest one, jumped off, and just like, I don't know if it's on video, but just screamed shit at the top going
Yeah,
down.
I don't know why people like to do that, but I admire them and will watch them do it, but I will not partake in that. No.
Yeah.
No, thank you.
And my mom
That's pretty
also wanted
wild.
to.
Yeah.
And my mom also wanted to visit the Tezuque Pueblo, which is where we
Yes,
was nice.
yes.
It was a
Such a
little
cool
bit.
history there.
It was there's yeah, it was really history and really beautiful. It's kind of hard not to be racked by guilt, as you're going through. But other than that, just kind of, yeah, I don't, we explored a bunch of different things, man. I would love to go back. I had so much fun there.
Oh, good. It's calling you, so I think you should
Yeah.
follow through on that.
Even just hiking in the backyard, which the backyard is a desert, you just
Yeah,
take a long walk.
absolutely. Well, and a lot of people don't realize that, they feel they almost, well, what I love is that a lot of people don't realize there's a state in between Arizona and Texas.
Yeah.
And they also equate it with being a dry, hot desert like Arizona. So when I tell them that, I mean, tomorrow we have a 40% chance of snow, and we're high desert. We have pine trees. We have a whole it, across the whole state, you span all these different ecosystems and different types of weather climates. And I kind of like that a lot of people don't know much about it. I think that's beautiful.
Yeah, it keeps it it's for you and the people who are interested, you know what I mean? No, it's nice to have that spot.
But I feel like it does filter out those that are coming for a very specific, almost refined and reflective and honored sense of visiting a place rather than the kind of,
Right.
nuts, Florida, Disney World, all that
Yeah.
kind of stuff. So it's,
Yeah.
yeah.
Before I forget, we have, every single episode, Brock has he's developed.
The drawing.
Oh
Yeah,
yeah, okay,
I
right. So
listened
yeah.
to a couple episodes.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Oh, fantastic. Right. So
Awesome.
yeah, we're gonna do the drawing challenge. So as a reminder to our listeners, it's we have our guest pick out three items, anything off the top of their head, and Brock is going to turn them into something crazy.
I haven't seen them though. Where do I see the images?
Oh, well,
On
we'll send it
Instagram.
to you now as soon as it's done. But
Yeah.
yes, they are published on Instagram. Oh, also forget, I forgot to tell you, Brock is on a little bit of a delay. So if he chimes in randomly, it's because of the,
No problem. Okay, my first item will be a wood-burning stove. The second will be a cat. And the third, the Virgen de Guadalupe.
Okay. I don't know how to
Yeah.
spell that.
Here, I'll put it in the chat, Brock, and also you might have to research some images. You said Virgen de Guadalupe
Yeah,
or de la
yeah.
Guadalupe?
Virgen de Guadalupe. Yeah, her feast day is coming up, December 12th. Yeah, she's
There you
the
go.
patron saint of
Awesome.
Mexico. Yeah, it's like
Wonderful.
the combination of Don
Okay.
Ancine and Mary, the mother of that,
Yeah.
crazy debated 33-year-old man.
I we could I mean I could get into it. I'm all about Because I'm not, I'm the worst. I am what people hate across the board. I am agnostic, not atheist, not religious. I'm a big old question mark. Who knows?
Well, and same with me, even though I'm very spiritual, I'm not, I was raised Catholic, but I do not practice. I still have a weird love of the saints, but it's something about the Virgen de Guadalupe that for me, coming from a state that combines the conquered and the conquerors, she's this beautiful blend of taking an indigenous mythology and putting on top of it this colonized idea of this woman, and she represents all of that. And I just find that even though I don't consider myself religious, she is something that I continually find solace and groundedness in.
Oh, right. I get that. I wish I had that for sure. My household, you'll find a couple photos of Jesus, some stuff of Mary, then Zeus, and then, you know, a handful
of it, yeah.
Dragons, fairies. I mean, it's like a...
Well, it's all the myths, right? That's what we love. We love myths. It's all myths. Yeah.
No, I was raised on those stories. I was raised on, you know, the Greek mythology, the Norse mythology, a ton of Native American mythology.
Beautiful.
I still have some of the books, actually. I read them every now and then. Right. So actually, you know, the Catholicism, did that come from, I saw that you were raised by both a Vietnam vet and a civil rights activist, which is just seems like such a powerful mix.
Very, very powerful. And, you know, I remember a few years back, StoryCorps was coming through New Mexico and collecting stories of what a term that I despise is Hispano and Hispanic. I do not claim that, but they were, you know, it's a general term. They were collecting oral stories of Hispano families in New Mexico, and they had a little Airstream trailer set up at the National Hispanic Cultural Center in Albuquerque. And I decided to invite my father to do an interview and just ask some questions and get to know, how did you and my mom get together? Like what? Yeah. And what it came down to was he simply stated they both had similar beliefs in what the Chicano movement was going for after the Vietnam War. And she had been an activist in SNCC, the Student Nonviolent Coordinating Committee in the South, for many years in her early 20s, and eventually moved to New Mexico to work for the land grant movement up here in New Mexico with Reyes Tijerina Lopez, and he would come up here to go fishing, and they met and just, I feel, had the same passion for what was going on, which is not dissimilar to what's happening now with a lot of the movements and a lot of the recognition of the injustices and systemic racism. And they just kind of met on this plane of understanding, and that produced me as their only child, and definitely informed a lot of my life choices up until now and probably beyond from what they had fought for. They both went through their respective wars.
No, and, right, of course.
Yeah.
I mean, did your father, you know, fighting in the Vietnam War, did he face like, you know, as, because the thing is, I feel like we don't, something that we think about, because there's always this concept of when you're out in a war, this whole concept of brothers in arms, that whole thing, it doesn't matter who's from where, you're all the same, you know, part of the same unit fighting. But did he face like...
Well, to be honest, I don't know a lot about it.
Right.
And there are very few stories that he's been willing to share. And I get that. I respect that. And that does come along with that understanding of those who have been there. They don't feel a great urge to share because of what it represented to them. And I can only imagine from what I've been researching and learning and, you know, what I do know is that my father was drafted. He was an all-star baseball player and was drafted to play professionally. And when he had the chance to go to spring training, the racism there was so prevalent and so horrible that there was this choice he made to realize, I am not of use here. This is not the, I believe from, you know, what I've been told, he didn't feel that that's where he was most of use. So he then followed in his father's footsteps, being a serviceman, and enlisted himself and chose, you know, to go and did two tours. And I would hazard a guess that yes, there was the fact that I'm sure he and most of his, you know, compatriots were on the front lines that are, you know, that we know that the marginalized were most used the front lines. But I honestly am not privy to the details.
Yeah. And you know what,
the stories I have, you know, they're kind of funny and kind of this right. and that, but I don't know much about it.
No. And I get that, you know, of course that's it's, you know, I've learned that when it comes to the Vietnam War, there's people who can talk about it and then there's people who can't. Like there's that kind of it, you know? Okay. So it seems like you have, you know, two very open-minded parents, which, you know, when you tell them, hey, I want to go into theater, was, you know, what was that reaction like?
Well, I came to theater very late in my life. Interestingly enough, listening to your professor's podcast, Daphne, who I love so much. I was an educator first and still am an educator first.
Okay.
And I have the stories of when I was in second and third grade going to the library at my school that would have discarded books and you could take whatever you wanted. And I would take the teacher's manuals, the workbooks, and I would go home and I'd create homework and organize my stuffed animals. And I wanted to play school because my mother was a professor as well. And my father was also, he started the North Valley Little League. He's been a coach always. So I learned from both of them the amazing impact of being a mentor and a teacher. So education was my first love. And it wasn't until I was 30, after getting a master's degree in special education, I taught middle school for 5 years in downtown Albuquerque, that I decided that I really understood the impact of theater and how it could help those with exceptionalities in either behavioral issues or just not understanding, just not fitting in, you know, those that we coin as special ed, that theater really can be a benefit to those students. So I decided that I really wanted, I'm an academicaholic, like seriously, I love academia so much. I will go on to get my PhD soon, but it wasn't until I was 30 that I auditioned for this acting program and decided, oh, I'm just gonna get an MFA so I can get into a college and teach, and then kind of haphazardly ended up becoming a professional actor for the past 9 years now. Yeah, 2011, 2008 or 9 years. And so it just kind of fell in my lap, but I also feel that there was some ancestral like movement in the works that knew that I realized that education, even working as a barista, as a bartender, all the weird jobs of being a nanny, all of that comes down to that core feeling of humans wanting to tell stories.
Right.
So when it comes to it all, I'm a storyteller in all the different weird ways that I am. Right. And my parents have been amazingly supportive. They've traveled to Cincinnati, Dallas, New York, San Miguel de Allende, Los Angeles, Oregon. They've traveled more following my theatrical career than they did before I was born, you know.
Yeah, actually, I was going to say, so my mom is an acting coach as well, which, you know, frequent listeners and Brock himself probably freaking sick of me saying, but and yeah, so I've seen, you know, from the bits and pieces I've seen of her classes, especially when it comes to working with, you know, with students who are, what was the term you used that just sounded much?
I use exceptional. It was a term that I learned from a couple of my professors in my master's in education. We don't try to say that it's a detriment or anything negative. It's just an exception. You just happen to be outside of the norm.
Right. So, yeah. So she said, you know, I've seen some of the impact, and she's even said it herself. She loves working with exceptional students because theater is just such an open and fluid way for them to be able to communicate, you know, and express everything, you know, because and while, you know, academia sure has been changing lately, especially with a lot of different kinds of alternative educations, you know, surfacing in the last, I don't know, I'm trying to think of like maybe Waldorf, however far back that goes. There still are some like rigid, you know, there are these rigid systems in place that, you know, don't allow everybody to express themselves how they want to. So,
It's the big proliferation of STEM, right? Let's do science, technology, engineering, which is great, but it is, you know, as the filmmaker Jean Cocteau, the amazing French filmmaker, he says, art is, you know, science in the flesh. Like it really, when you really get into statistics or any of those like crazy engineering, architecture, it's art. It really is art. It is the human capacity to completely fulfill an amazing, almost magical thing.
Yeah.
You can't help but know that there's artistry in all of those things.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, one of our previous guests is...
he makes apps.
Yeah.
That's an art form in itself. I mean, look at these apps. I recently had a summer school with my nieces, and for our warm-ups, they had to teach me TikTok dances. And I'm like, hold up. These kids are, this is like theater rehearsal. They are looking at these videos over and over again, learning these routines and physically moving to like nail it. I love it.
Yeah.
It's fantastic.
Yeah, I know that provides a you know, fantastic and just interesting mix. So this the program you got your MFA from was USC, I believe, right?
Correct. Yes.
And I saw that was Luis Alfaro himself involved in the program? I saw that his name was attached to it.
Yeah. So Luis and I have a crazy story. I'll try to do it in like a little, you know, succinct. Luis received the MacArthur Genius Award, I believe, in 1997. My mother was a recipient in 1990 for her organizing and work up here in northern New Mexico. And what they used to do is in Chicago, they would gather every 18 months and kind of invite the new class of recipients to share their work with those that had already received it and just kind of, you know, networking, community, in a hotel for 3 days, you'd go to seminars. My mom would pull me out of school. And the requirement was that I'd have to go to these different lectures and seminars of all these new recipients of the MacArthur Genius Award. And when I was 17 or 18, Luis had won and got to see one of his solo performances. And then in 2008, before I left to LA, we produced Electricidad with my theater company, Teatro Nuevo Mexico, which I performed. And when I got into USC and showed up, he happened to be a professor there. And I took a class with him my third year of grad school at USC. And then we've continued to have this amazing relationship where I've done all three of his Greek adaptations, which just recently got published, the Greek trilogy of Luis Alfaro. And so it's been nuts. We just recently CTG, the Center Theater Group in LA, just recently filmed during COVID all three of his adaptations, and they're available online until January 20th to stream for free.
Right. We will definitely, I'll ask you for all that information because I saw that that came out. And that's, yeah, no, that's fantastic that you got cast in, you know, what are his, you know, arguably his most popular pieces, trilogy of tragedies. I read Oedipus el Rey and Electricidad. I didn't read the middle one, but so that was that the you acted in all three of them or just in Mojada?
I've done all three. It began right after grad school, my first equity job. I booked his first iteration of the Medea tragedy that was called Bruja at the Magic Theater in San Francisco, directed by Loretta Greco. And it was a very straight up adaptation from the classic. And then it went on to Chicago, LA, Oregon, New York, and I was lucky enough to be a part of many of those iterations. Right. In 2014, I went to Dallas and did Oedipus el Rey and got to play Jocasta. And then in 2008, the first one was Electricidad. So I've done all three.
Did you move to LA for that program, by the way?
I had been currently in my master's program for special education and knew that I wanted to get an MFA in theater, but I couldn't decide between directing or acting because I started as a director. I began as a director in undergrad, realizing that most of the programming in Albuquerque, New Mexico did not reflect the Latino indigenous population.
Right.
And felt like, okay, well, how am I gonna take care of this? Great, I'll do my own shit. So I started producing work by New Mexico playwrights and was a director for many, many years before I started kind of dipping my toes into acting. I weirdly am an introvert. I'm very extroverted when it comes to, I just love people, but when it really comes down to it, I was a very shy child. So a lot of people that have known me when I'm little that now have seen me in TV shows and on stage, they're like, what? I would start crying to have to say hi to people. I just didn't like, it was very, anyway. So I scouted a few MFA programs in the California area, a little bit in New York, and the beautiful Sergio Ramirez that works for USC would constantly stay in touch with me and would send me emails and say, "Dear prospective Trojan, just want to let you know what's going on in this MFA program." And it was very new. It started in 2006. So when I finally auditioned and got in, I was only part of the third class that produced MFA grads. They've now, I think we're in our 10th or 11th graduating class. So now we have a 100 or so graduates out of this amazingly dynamic MFA program.
Oh, that's fantastic. I I suppose transition, because you didn't transition directly from New Mexico to LA, right? You explored some different.
No, I did. I did. So, I went straight up. Right. When I found out I got into USC, we were in the middle of the horrible tests that students have to go through, those standardized tests. And my principal I sent her an email and I said, "Oh my goodness, I got in. I'm gonna have to leave. I'm gonna have to quit my job." I had just gotten the full-time job as the drama teacher in the middle school to work with 6th, 7th, and 8th grade students. And she went over the intercom, told everybody to put their pencils down and said, "Just want to let you know, Ms. Zuniga got into USC. She's going to be leaving us." I had to leave my students. I had to pack up and take off. And it was a big, rough, quick transition, but something that I obviously manifested. So I had to follow through.
you know, I'm with that. And sorry, I lean back because when you said standardized testing, I just even with the SATs, I think that that's like, I took them twice. So 8 hours of my life are, to this day, down the toilet. Like, it's just
totally, totally. Awful. Yeah, I had to do the ACTs twice as well.
Oh, God.
That's bullshit.
So, I mean, moving to LA, did you face like, maybe not a culture shock, but did you face like a, you know, population shock, right? Because you move from, you know, New Mexico, which is this very spread out and, you know, its largest community is in Albuquerque. And then you move to LA, which is huge. So what, I mean, what part of LA did you move to? And like, did that, you know, what were some of the, you know, fundamental differences you found?
You know, what's lovely about LA is it had been a part of my reality for a very long time, because growing up, a lot of the cinema that I watched took place in LA. Boys in the Hood, Mi Vida Loca, American Me, Blood In, Blood Out, Mi Familia, all of those kind of Chicano cinematic masterpieces lived in my mind. So I had this idea of LA when I was just a teenager. So moving there, lovely enough, having this gorgeous connection to theater, I was able to get this beautiful, you won't believe it, gorgeous studio apartment in West Adams off of like Crenshaw and La Brea for $525 a month for my own studio apartment in LA. By Elizabeth Otero, who's an amazing playwright. She happened to be moving in with her fiance and she said, oh, I heard you're getting into grad school. Would you like to take over my apartment? Yes, $525 a month. Are you kidding me? And moving in there, it reminded me of those shots in Boys in the Hood, that gorgeous South Central with those gorgeous lawns and the palm trees and the jacaranda trees. It blew my mind. And for about 2 years, I think my jaw would be open driving around, looking at the skyline of LA. And I'm just like, oh my God, I'm driving around in the landscape of these cinematic films that I'd been watching for years, years. And eventually I moved to Pasadena for a little bit and then landed in Boyle Heights. And living in Boyle Heights, that was, oh my God, that was all of it. That was those films, going to Echo Park and Mi Vida Loca and all of that stuff. It's just LA always had a presence, even living in small town Albuquerque. So it felt like I was elevating my Chicanidad, if that makes sense.
No, so, for sure.
Yeah.
You know, I see that having grown up, you know, in Miracle Mile on the West Side, and I'm in Culver City and everything like that. I think the first time we have friends that live in East LA, and we used to head down there all the time. But, you know, first time I ever visited Boyle Heights was when I was 16 and I was performing there with a dance theater company.
Yes.
And we performed in the square, you know, where they got that, you know, got the stage with the
Mariachi Plaza. Yes.
That was wonderful. I had so much fun. And we just like,
oh, there's nothing like Boyle Heights. It's when I finally moved there in the last couple of years, I finally realized, oh, this is the LA that I really connected to, even though it was through cinema. This is the LA, the Chicanidad, that just kind of permeated my understanding of being in a big city. So I felt okay being there, even though I was from, you know, small town New Mexico.
Really? The glitzy Hollywood streets and the, you know, big showbiz thing, that didn't attract you? That's
no, not at all. And I think that's maybe it's something that I like have a privilege of, coming from my grounded New Mexico roots. I didn't feel, and maybe it's also because I went there when I was 30. I wasn't a young 20 something packing up my car, putting all my dreams into one thing. You know, I feel that maybe it was a good thing that I didn't get there until later in life. So I didn't have that kind of, yeah, wrapped up in the Hollywood glitz.
I was, when I first wanted to get into filmmaking, I was wrapped up in the Hollywood glitz for just a bit, and now I hate it. I can't, every time somebody says you want to, like, somebody from another state or country visits and they want to see the Walk of Fame, I'm like, can we?
Oh, geez, I know. Well, and it's so interesting. Recently, I read an article about somebody who lives just outside of that Hollywood area and how empty those streets are now. And there are still a few tourists that show up that just want to walk around and like find the stars that represent, you know, whoever they love. And but the Chinese theater now, to be able to go see the handprints, you have to pay like $5 to get in. And it's just like this ghost town.
It's, which, if anything, is almost on a dark level symbolic of the film industry itself.
Yeah. I'm kind of finding pleasure in it. Like, you know what? It's okay. Yeah, it's all a fucking charade. Yeah. It's all glitz and glamour that adds up to nothing. It's, you know, sound and fury. But I do still, I mean, there were times that in LA I'd go to some rooftop bar or whatever and be like, oh, I'm in LA, oh, this is crazy. It was short-lived, but it was still, I still did have that kind of thrill of the glitz.
It's fun sometimes just to get a little bit of it, to feel that, you know, the thing you see in all the TV shows and the movies.
Exactly.
The once upon a time in Hollywood, you know, experience.
Yes, exactly.
In the recent years doing TV, so I saw that, you know, you did a couple episodes of Snowfall and had a guest role on Madam Secretary, both of which I have yet to watch. Snowfall has been like on my radar since it came out. It always looks
amazing. Oh my God, it is one of the most exquisite films. Not films, sorry. I say films because it's John Singleton. The motherfucker was 16 out of South Central, hanging out in the film library at USC. And at 22, was at the Cannes Film Festival. Yeah. Like, talk about a filmmaker extraordinaire who came from where he came from and continued to portray his real life in his medium. Wow. Wow. Snowfall is one of my top, I would say, 10 TV shows because of the cinematography is gorgeous. The acting is gorgeous. What they really decide to really get real about what happened with the CIA and what was going on in Nicaragua and the drug wars and what really, I geek out about it and I forget that I'm even in it. You know, I auditioned for that shit all first season, second season, third season, second season, I got to meet John Singleton. I got to go to a like executive like audition with like all the producers and like see everybody. Finally, third season, I made it, you know? Yeah. But I didn't give a fuck. I was like, if I could just get one episode, I don't care. This fucking show is bomb.
Yeah.
And I'm very proud of that show. I'm very proud to be a part of it. I think it's one of the most beautiful pieces of television in the past couple of years.
And then Madam Secretary, how did that come about? I imagine the, you know.
So Madam Secretary came about because there is this brilliant, amazing casting director named Mark Sachs, who works for CBS and loves theater actors. And I auditioned for him many, many times. I made a point, because I love New York so much, made a point that after I graduated USC that I would go live in New York for a couple months at a time and audition, because I knew a lot of beautiful stuff was being cast out of there. And Mark Sachs is, I just believe, one of the most, just, yeah, he's an artist when it comes to casting, and he really believes in theater actors. And I went into his casting room so many times and just happened to go in for this random role. And it just happened. And it turned out to be like, you know, a good 5-episode arc. And it didn't feel out of the ordinary that a Latina looking how I look could be a deputy press secretary. There was no big deal of like, oh, look at her taking, no. I mean, already the press secretary was, you know, beautiful, Daisy, who played the press secretary. It just, that was one of the most amazing sets I've ever been on. It's all love, Tim Daly, Tia Leone. Oh my God. It was just mind blowing. But it felt very just natural. Just going into work, doing this thing. It's not a big deal. Here we go.
Yeah. So, I mean, when it comes to casting, when it comes to, you know, diversifying your cast, and the thing is, there's something I've been seeing a lot of commentary on, like, don't, you know, on there's some people who take issue with, you know, with pieces that, I mean, to be quite frank, like, aren't quite good, but like are revered for having like this super diverse cast, and saying, don't sacrifice mediocrity for diversity. Have them work together, mm-hmm. like create mm-hmm. something good and diverse and tell these stories with the quality that they deserve to be told. But that's beside the question here. It's just a point I kind of wanted to make.
I agree with you. I love what you just said is we're not trying to just fill the room with those that have been underrepresented. We're trying to fill the room with those that have the skills and the teeth.
Yeah.
And they just happen to be what we haven't seen before. There's a big difference.
Yeah. So, I mean, like when you look at casting and you look at both on the stage and in film and television where they almost do like this, like, you know what I mean? Like,
look what we got.
Yeah,
look what like, we did.
You know, where the show is clearly trying to fill some sort of slot and token, and it's not done out of a love for diversity or a want to, you know, to include everyone. It's done out of a fear. Don't judge us. We're doing, you know, we're like, it's yeah. like that. It's done from this very small, it's even more close-minded point, because it's dishonest. Like I have no respect for anyone who's prejudiced or you know, well, racist at this point, but like they have more honesty than people who try to hide in it. So, I mean, where have you seen that, or have you seen that in your own experience?
You know, it's an interesting point. It's really hard to... It's like, why are you choosing? Are you choosing to make these casting decisions because you feel that it's this idea of normal, right? That's something that drives me crazy. It's like, what is normal? What is the new normal? There are certain shows that are deciding to say, we're just going to tell our story and we're going to do it in our own way and we're just going to go nuts. And it's not going to be about mainstream. You look at Vida, right? Which was by Tania Saracho, which just really went nuts with, we're just going to tell a story about a neighborhood. We're just going to go nuts. We're going to go like really forward with sexuality, female sexuality, because a lot of television is based on patriarchal sexuality.
Right.
Right. So Vida was just like unapologetically, like, we're just going to go here and you're going to deal with it. And if you don't like it, fine. Cause you're not used to it. Then that says something, right? You look at Gentified, that for me, being somebody who has a darker complexion, different features that are not Eurocentric when it comes to Latinidad, what I loved about Gentified on Netflix is it really showcases beautiful, gorgeous faces, different skin tones that I don't usually get to see. I didn't grow up with that, you know? And so I feel like there are, I do love the streaming services that are deciding to showcase that, yeah, and really show those different perspectives that are, they are normal. It's not abnormal.
Yeah.
You know, and I mean, I consume a lot of television. I am a television. I cannot stop. Right now, we just had our first, I'm a Grey's Anatomy-aholic. I don't care who's dropped off the boat after 17 seasons. I've been watching Die Hard forever. And we have our first Indigenous Native American actor on Grey's Anatomy from New Mexico. And so I just, yeah, I feel like it's out there. Television, I think in the past 5 to 8 years has been able to embrace a lot more diversity and like realistic reflections. But you know what I find fascinating? I feel like the commercial realm has really been the one to embrace it the most. And nobody's really talked about that. We get multiracial families. We get intergenerational things. We get LGBTQ representation on commercials. It's, yeah, it's beautiful. Yeah. I mean, Cheerios got taken down for a second, but it was like, nah, we're stronger than that. I've been very impressed with the commercial representation over the past decade. They've been the ones embracing the most of, let's really reflect what our society is in the United States.
I kind of see that. Yeah. Now that I think about it, because, you know, hey, I'm a student. I'm on the Hulu student plan, so we still got ads. But like, you know, yeah. Oh, my God. I actually totally see that.
The amount of commercials that have mixed race couples, blended families. It's beautiful. It's amazing.
Regarding your group, the Teatro Nuevo Mexico, how have you guys worked to, you know, amplify Latinx voices and Latinx theater in general? Have you focused, I mean, I'm sure you focus on plays that are by Latinx playwrights, as well as, you know, reaching out to students from the Latinx community specifically. But I mean, so what methods do you guys take?
Well, unfortunately, I have not been involved with them since I moved to LA.
Right.
That was very much like a decade from what happened was after graduating from undergrad, I realized, and along with a lot of my compatriots there, that just there wasn't, you know, Albuquerque back in the late 60s, along with Teatro Campesino, we had this beautiful theater company, La Compañía de Albuquerque, that was doing this incredible work in the 70s, 80s, 90s, that just kind of fizzled out with the generation. So in those early 2000s, we decided to get together with a lot of community members, theater folks, and create this company and do primarily Latinx work. But when I moved away, unfortunately, I wasn't able to stay a part of it. But what we had done in our model was really focusing on Mexican playwrights, Chicano playwrights, Carlos Morton, Josefina Lopez, Victor Hugo Rascón Banda, and just really trying to highlight the profound amount of literature and work that is done by those of us in the Spanish speaking, you know, languages. And so unfortunately it's not going on anymore because of, you know, just fizzling out and stuff. But it was at the time really what I loved about it was bringing together those community members that were fantastic, not just actors, not just directors, lighting technicians, stage managers, people that were in all different realms of this beautiful art form were creating this work in Albuquerque has this gorgeous theater, the National Hispanic Cultural Center. That's like an almost 600 seat theater. That is insane. The 25th anniversary of Zoot Suit went through there, which I took all my middle school students to, but it's a gorgeous playhouse that I just hope to one day, and I'm just going to put it out there because I think manifesting is a real thing. And I feel like when you do really focus on something, it can happen. I really hope to bring back theater to Albuquerque and maybe form an equity house at this theater where people can get paid both on stage, behind the stage, and all of that. But all the people, Joseph Wasson and the people that worked at the National Hispanic Cultural Center, produced some of the most amazing theater in that decade from 2000 to 2010.
How, I guess I kind of could, so we touched on it, but I almost want to ask, like, you know, just some, do you have like highlights from working on this like amazing, you know, Greek, you know, trilogy, Luis Alfaro sets, like how, you know, I don't know, like, what was that just not mind blowing, you know, to work on these, and I know you did it several times, right? Several different iterations.
Yeah. It's been something that I didn't even know was going to become this huge part of my life in terms of having the honor of representing a story. I'm going to specifically speak about the play Mojada, which is his Medea adaptation, which when you look at it and you know Greek tragedy, Medea was one of the first immigrant stories written about. A woman who decided, because of love and because of power and because of all of those beautiful things, decided to follow her heart and leave her home and start anew with this man that she loved. And things went awry and tragedy, you know, it ensued. But when Luis decided to focus it on the immigrant experience and what it really means to achieve this American dream, which drives me crazy because America goes from Canada to Chile. So we could say the United States dream. What does it mean to sacrifice? What does it mean to really have true love to where you're both willing to do anything you can for your child? And having done the play 5 times now over the past 7 years, I have been elated to know that there are many, many folks, especially in Oregon, New York, San Francisco, who have never had an ability to really understand what that means to go through that, to sit and watch a play for 90 minutes. And see what it means for a family to cross the border. And the fact that 75% of women that cross the border are raped or sexually assaulted. And what that means for them and what they're doing to just try and have a better life. There's times when being an actor, I feel very selfish and that I'm doing something that's causes me to miss weddings, funerals, birthdays, holidays with my family. But when I get to do it in a work of art that is abiding to the social justice regime that I feel like I was raised with my parents, I realize that I've been given this gift and honor. It's a weight. It's hard doing that show for 8 times a week, most recently in New York, and having to relive these horrors that people have gone through. They're going through right now. Yeah. Right now. People are dying and being molested and accosted at the border right now. So it's a privilege and it's a weight, but I am immensely honored that I was and still am able to be a part of that, you know. And it's just the voiceless need that storytelling. And that's, you know, the Greeks did it. We've all done it. You look back at any culture, you look back at any text, oral tradition, written tradition, we talk about it. It's the human condition.
Well, I don't, hey man, the educator side of you totally surfaced there.
Wow. It's yeah.
No, I felt that. You know, when learning acting, I suppose I want to talk a little bit more about craft. And this is where people go, oh, you pretentious sack of shit. But, you know, you know, in this MFA program you took, what methods do they teach you specifically, and which one do you subscribe to now, you know, as you...
Oh, I love that question. I think it's brilliant. So I think one of the number one lessons that I learned is by the time we're all 2 years old, we've experienced everything that humanity goes through. Loss, hunger, love, excitement, despair. We know that by the time we're 2 years old. The crazy thing about being in an MFA program was basically I spent hundreds of thousands of dollars to get back to that beautiful root of what it means to be this weird species that we are as a human. And when it comes to a character, there's a difference between putting on a character and the character coming out of you. And in the program, what they really taught us was the character is a small percentage. You are a spectrum. And the character fits into that spectrum in whatever different part it needs to. We've all been through everything we need to go to relate to any character we come across as an artist. And the number one thing is flexibility and not being rigid and not judging where our story and the words come from in whatever character that we're doing. And really understanding that whether you're male or you're female, the emotions, the struggles, the strife, we've all been there. So for somebody to feel like, oh, I'm privileged, I've never felt struggle. Yes, you have in your own way. Or for somebody to feel like, oh, I've struggled so much, I could never play a king or a queen. Yes, you can. Yes, you can. You have exalted when you've succeeded in something. So it's a beautiful lesson that I feel that going through the USC program in the folks that taught us was not only that flexibility in the mind, but there was also a very rigorous physical training. We were being asked to do the work that we were doing headstands, backbends, fucking somersaults over our professor, where we're freaking out. And he's like, yeah, I'm standing up. You're going to fucking do a somersault over me. And we're like, what the fuck? Yeah. They scared the fuck out of us. They tore us down. They built us up. And I like to say that part of it was they asked us to eviscerate ourselves, basically cut open your insides, throw your entrails down and make something out of it. And then put it back inside of you. And know that no matter where you come from, you have everything inside of you to create and contribute.
That is so deep and so gory. You
it's
know,
so gory. It's so gory. That's why I love the Greeks.
No, but like, no, that's wonderful. I think, you know, that's a really interesting, you know, teaching method, because, you know, there's, and not while, you know, not, I'm not taking anything away from the greats. In fact, my mom was trained in Stanislavskian method, and that's kind of,
oh, what, yeah,
she, specifically herself. She teaches at the Lee Strasberg Institute. So, you know, there's,
yeah,
that whole thing going. But this feels, I don't know, it feels like a really strong mixture of, you know, those older, I'm not going to say outdated, but, you know, just kind of older.
It's indigenous. Yeah. Here's the deal. One of the things that I have an issue with is when, especially with our beautiful white brethren and sisters that feel like, oh, I don't have any culture. Oh, I don't, you're so lucky. You're so from, no, every culture, every bloodline has an indigenous connection to storytelling and the need for really getting down and dirty. Mm-hmm. Every, the Norse, I love that you're into Norse mythology. Anybody who's like, oh, I'm just nothing. I'm like, no, but what are you? Oh, I'm like Polish and Irish and this. I'm like, oh my God. Can you investigate those mythologies? Because every single bloodline on this fucking crazy rock that we're riding around the goddamn sun, every goddamn bloodline has a beautiful mythology. And if you discover that and you go deep with it, you're going to find that you're indigenously connected to everybody else, to the entire, the trees, the birds, the bees, all of it. And that's what I love about those that have become, you know, yeah, the Greeks, Shakespeare, blah, 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 all of that. But it's really actually connected to everybody. We all bleed. We all know shame. We all know hurt. We all know desire.
Yeah.
You know, it's all very connected.
I think that's something that we tend to forget a lot. And you know, actually, I was just today, actually, in Dr. Secret's classes, literally, you know, 30 minutes before we just started.
God, I love her so much. She's so brilliant.
No, she's fantastic. This is the third class I've taken with her. So she's like,
awesome. Yeah.
So, you know, she asked us one last time, ending of the semester, what is Latinx theater? And, you know, I talked about how it's a celebration at its core. What I notice about all the plays you read is it's a celebration of Latinx culture and identity. It's basically saying we're here, whether, mm-hmm. you know, you're talking about topics that may be very specific, like immigration and racial injustice and prejudice. But then the thing that makes these plays so beautiful and accessible to everybody and, you know, cover these universal themes is they talk about heartbreak and family and mm-hmm. you know, love and tragedy mm-hmm. and encapsulate everyone as a human, because I mean that's what I notice is that these plays and these pieces, you know, they're given these labels because they're meant to uplift and celebrate a certain group of people, but at the same time they're reminders that hey, we're all, you know, like
we're all one.
Yeah, it's
profound when you're able to reach that point. Yeah.
This is another, our last episode got pretty hippy dippy, and this one too. I like it.
Oh, I love hippy dippy. That's my favorite.
Brock, what are we thinking?
I need like 45 seconds.
Great.
Okay. All right. Yeah. And after that, if it's on Photoshop, can you like, I don't know, can you just export it as a JPEG and just shoot it to me in an email? I can share my screen and just show it.
Yeah. Yeah.
What's easier?
I love this. I so even besides acting, I've been an artist for a very long time since I was young. So nice. I do a lot of abstract art. And I remember being in college and having to tell my professors, if I'm not looking at you and I'm in my notebook, it's not that I'm not paying attention. I just have to doodle. I have to put pen to paper to be able to like hear and listen. And when I listened to your episode, your first couple episodes that you shared, I appreciate and love this idea of conversation in connection with creation on the paper. No, I like it too. So I love that you guys.
Yeah,
have
it's
that
nice.
Aspect.
It's kind of fun. I like that. You know, it helps set our show apart a little bit because hey, there's like what 45 million podcasts in the world. Everyone's
yeah.
And you know, as a testament to specifically what you do, this is my like, you know, I like to, I, my mind always has to be working. So yeah. So this is
that
during, class, I'll be, it's muscle memory and memorization, but,
that just blows my mind.
But during class, when I'm talking, you know, or when I'm listening, the professor may see me looking down, especially now that we're at home and this thing's always here as a distraction. This is what I mean. Like, this is my version of drawing. And while I'm, you know, a filmmaker at heart, I can't exactly be here, you know, shooting a film while the
But you're keeping yourself, yeah, you're keeping that part of your brain. Did you learn that or did you experiment and figure it out yourself?
This is, I think it's one of my mathematician friends said it's physically impossible to learn or to experiment, figure it out yourself.
You have to learn.
Yeah, you have to learn it and memorize it. And then it ultimately turns into muscle memory to the point where you can do certain parts of it. Oh, I screwed it up. Hold on. You can do certain parts of it without looking eventually. And then there are those people that, you know, use their like photographic memory and eidetic memory and different techniques like that to.
That like, blows my mind.
Look it over once and then do the whole thing with their eyes closed.
Oh my God. I've seen those shows where they like do the timers and they got the blindfolds and it's just like, what the fuck? And I love the idea that it's through touch and muscle memory.
Mm-hmm.
I think that's something interesting because I think I had originally thought, oh, yes. I had originally thought that it was some sort of, I don't know, but I love the idea that it's just this learned kind of, yeah, muscle memory. And, yeah.
It's really soothing, I think, especially to a mind that's constantly like wandering and thinking and questioning. And I'm not trying to do the whole tortured artist thing like that, but there are so many times where I'm constantly like, I have a thought and then immediately I have to start analyzing it from every perspective and ultimately ask my question, did you really mean that thought? Is that what you, or are you thinking of yourself in this meta? Do you ever watch Community? Dan Harmon?
Yes. Oh, show? Yes. Yes.
So, sure. Because they're all the characters are kind of, you know,
I think characters. It's like one person's brain. And all the different parts.
Yeah. Yeah. So that's what they kind of are. So I always identified a little bit with like Abed's pulling away from the world and looking at it from this whole meta perspective as if it's a film. And I'm not saying I do it to the extent that he does because that is, well, you know, it's a television show, it's fantasy, but you know, that happens a lot, you know, I'll pull myself out of a situation, like I'll be in a situation, I'll pull myself out of it and almost be looking at it from this like third party view, just kind of imagining how it looks and what is a viewer I would want the person to do next. It's so bizarre and so weird.
But don't you believe that's kind of the artist lens?
I think so. That's what, you know, that's what I've been told a couple times, and that definitely helps because, you know, I have a tendency to do that and then judge myself, be like, weirdo, get back in it, you know, get back in the moment.
I love that idea of it's perspective, right? And the ability to have that kind of bird's eye view and kind of have that. But yes, a lot of times society is just like, get back in and do your thing, get in line, you know, but I believe it's a artist spirit.
Well, that's certainly, it's stuff like that that helps me look at it in a different light. All right, so it looks like Brock is pretty much done. He's probably.
Oh, he's sending it? Oh my goodness.
Yeah, I've stopped drawing.
this is so cool.
Saving it to send.
Here we are. Is that coming through with enough detail? I can zoom
in. Oh my gosh. It actually looks, and she's in there.
Yeah, she's in there peeking out of him.
In there. Mm-hmm. And you have no idea. That looks almost exactly like, I'm going to show you my.
Yeah.
That looks almost exactly like the one from my house.
Yeah. There it is.
This is wonderful. This is ours.
Oh, it's totally. Oh, I love it so much. Oh, that's perfect. Okay, so you're gonna email that to me, yeah?
Yeah, no, I'll forward it to you right now from my let me grab it because this is my email that I sent it to, my personal one, and I emailed you from my school email. So I'll go ahead and forward this to you now.
Oh, I love it. Great.
Yeah, no, it's what it looks fantastic, Brock. This is Jesus, the perspective, everything, you nailed it. And look, you drew Eggsy. That's awesome.
Okay. Yay!
Yeah,
but okay, that looks amazing. Well, Sabina, thank you so much for sitting down with us. This went fantastic. It was a wonderful interview.
I had a great time. I'm not going to remember anything that was said, so I'll be excited to hear what happens. But I usually have that. I do interview blackouts awesome. Where I just like have a great time, and then afterwards I'm just like, what did I even say?
No, I'm with that. That's sometimes fair. Where I have to. Yeah, at least it makes it interesting when I go back and listen to and edit it. Because when I listen to the episode, when I edit the episodes, I listen to the entire thing through.
Oh, that's fun. Oh, yay.
So I make sure, yeah, that everything sounds good. Well, yeah, thank you so much for joining us. And
absolutely.
When you've got something new coming up, you know, just reach out, hit us up on Instagram, email, or, well, we have each other's phone numbers. You can text me and we'll set up another one and just chat.
That sounds great. Thank you both so much.
Thank you so much for listening. I hope you enjoyed listening to the interview just as much as we enjoyed conducting it. All right, as per usual, never miss an episode of So You're an Artist by subscribing to us on Spotify, iTunes, Google Play Music, or wherever you get your podcasts. Brock, where can they keep up with us for behind the scenes updates and drawing challenges?
Yes, keep up with us on Instagram and Twitter. Our Instagram is artist.pod and our Twitter is artist_pod. You can also write us a lovely email at syaapod@gmail.com. And also don't forget to leave us a review on iTunes. We'd really appreciate it.
And as per usual, if the review is negative, we'll just sweep it under the rug.
Of course.
All right. Well, from the entire creative team of me and Brock here at So You're an Artist, we wish you a very happy holiday.
Yes.
Christmas and all inclusive. Everyone, please have a wonderful holiday, especially fellow students. Enjoy your break. And we will see you again in the new year.
Happy New Year's as well.
Yes. Happy New Year ahead of time. All right, guys, that's going to do it for this episode of So You're an Artist. We'll see you soon.
Over and out.